Thursday, July 14th. Dog days have set in. There's an air of weariness, irritability, tenseness around the White House. How can I combat it? Two ways for myself and my side. I can thank all those people who do such a good job, day after day, all year, unnoticed. I don't do enough of that. That's one of Lyndon's wonderful qualities. He roars when he is angry. He thanks sweetly the moment that he feels like it, in colorful language. In his life, he's endeared a host of people to him in that way. The mood of the day was not helped by an article by Drew Pearson. LBJ is unable to shake three irritations: George Hamilton's draft status, stubborn daughter Lindbergh's trip to Europe, and Lucy's insistence on a big wedding, or the boys are dying in Vietnam. John and the Negleys had spent the night with us. There was an article in the paper about the reception he had hosted the night before as Commissioner General of the International Exposition Hemisphere, the members of the Texas delegation, and the ambassadors of all the countries concerned. And what was the headline? Connolly to Miss Wedding. Hemisphere is a pretty important thing. But it took second billing in Isabel Shelton's story for the fact that John wouldn't be at the wedding. But oh, delightfully, Nellie will. She will fly back from midway in the trip, she and Nancy. I'm so pleased at that. I spent the morning at my desk and then went down for the 11 o'clock swearing-in of Barney Bikini as director of the Humanities Commission. In the East Room, a speech by Lyndon, a word of reminiscence between me and Mrs. Keeney about that marvelous day at Brown when Lyndon got the honorary degree, and another day, the day of the multitudes during the campaign. We saw all of New England, and the cars nearly burned up. We stood in line and met all of the guests, members of the commission, his family and friends, art-minded folks in town, including Mrs. Bliss, who spoke to me in the line about wanting to see me sometime. I shall, over a teacup, quietly. It will be the greatest pleasure to discuss with her Dumbarton Oaks' beautification or whatever is on her mind. And then I went with Simone and Bess to the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception to review the seating plan. On the way, Simone proposed to me a sort of a meet-the-press interview with me and Lucy and a TV panel. But each succeeding word, I withdrew more and more, and finally said just no, no, no. The Shrine, of course, is open to the public, and as we drove up, not only was the public there in full force, but a cameraman at the foot of the lengthy steps. Nothing to do but dismount with a smile, murmur yes, we'll be going in to review some plans, and mount the steps. I am staggered by the immensity of it. We counted sections and sat down in pews to estimate how many comfortably on a hot August day could occupy them, multiplied and planned where to seat the cabinet and the senate and the house, and of course to first the families. I was asked if I would like to sit beyond the rail in the several pews usually reserved for officiating our visiting clergy, much, much closer to the great canopied altar in the center. That was an easy answer. No. I want to sit with all the guests. It would offend my sense of propriety for us to move into a section reserved for the Catholic clergy, we who are not even Catholics. I was aghast, however, but a long, long distance away, the guests will be from the bride and groom, since the service will last more than an hour. I asked Bess if all the wedding party, 24 of them, would stand or kneel. They have no pews to kneel against there around that great altar. In her calm, smiling way, she said they were experimenting, she and the Monsignor, small satin stools that might ease it a bit for them. We talked about the flower arrangements, the bank of three trees on each side of the altar, round, clipped, decorated with white blossoms, white bouquet on every fourth pew. So where the 100-voice choir will sit up in the loft, but no Mendelssohn or Lohengrin, for that I am sad. We shall have to have it over and over again at the White House. No need to worry about whether the service will be heard by the wedding guests, far away though it is. All the officiating clergy wear wireless mics, but what of the bride and groom? They'll have to have very clear voices indeed. Even inside the church, every tourist had a camera, and I was constantly being photographed. Back at the White House was a stag luncheon for the Prime Minister of Australia. John and Alfred went to it, and Nancy and I had lunch alone. And then, most delicious luxury, I had an hour and a half nap. Two remedies for all ailments, are sleep and work. And so next, I applied myself to the second of these. I had an hour session with Margaret Deeb, who so efficiently prepared the wedding list, which is broken down into all sort of categories. Relatives, friends, National Cathedral, Camp Mystic, doctors, urgent relatives, Pat's friends, clergy. Because I love to use all the beautiful places of this wonderful house and not just confine myself to the second floor, I'd chosen the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden for my long staff sessions. It was pleasant there under the arbor, the clusters of green grapes above us, the lovely green sweep of zoysia, clipped and perfect, fountain tinkling at the end of the garden, and the two of us comfortably spread out with our notebooks and papers on the cushioned wicker furniture. I hope Margaret left with a real understanding of how much I appreciate her excellent work. My next appointment was Sharon Francis, who is chief letter writer and speech writer of Operation Beautification, and what a job that is turning into. Weekly, the letters are running 201, 223, 246, fed by the flame of all newspaper and magazine articles, by speeches, and the last by local controversies. The best thing this morning in the Barney Bikini line was to meet Bagdikian, who had written the marvelous article in Saturday Evening Post, and I had a chance to tell him so, face to face, with full admiration. Sharon and I had accumulated business. How to answer the dozens of letters about the Grand Canyon controversy, the building of the dam in it, about the possibility of a special small office for her. She would adore it. It would relieve the situation, crowding, the sometimes difficulty of two very different people in one office. We spent a very productive hour, I think. How often I remember A.W.'s maxim, the best fertilizer for any man's ranch, the footsteps of the owner. With Margaret and Sharon, I had had a glass of iced tea, but by the time Ashton came at 7:30, it was very pleasant to have a gin and tonic as the lovely evening settled around us and the Washington Monument turned from white to pink to dark. I dictated lists for pictures to be made during the wedding reception, a small list of Lucy's most sentimental or somehow very special gifts, answered mail, and finally at 9 o'clock sent that dear girl home and I went to the bowling alley. But not before Lucy came fluttering in, Mama, Mama, woefully distressed, because women's wear daily had broken the release on her bridesmaids' dresses, and she thought also on her wedding gown, Mama, why would anybody do something so mean? Personally, I didn't think it was any great matter. Two games of bowling, and then back upstairs to wait for Lyndon. I'd phoned, and he said he'd be at dinner at 10. It was 10:50 when he came with Bob Kettner. By that time, Lyndon is ravenous, and it's very hard for him to restrain himself. Whenever we return from the ranch, we have gained weight, and we're each determined to lose, for me, 3 pounds, for him, more. There's enormous willpower when it comes to hours of work, to any job that lays before him. It's hard to summon up when it comes to leaving off that dessert, that second helping of something he likes. I was pleased to see how quiet and easy and full of good ideas, calmly presented, Bob Kettner was. He's working into being a very valuable member of the team.